The framework that Debbie spoke so brilliantly about last week begins with just being aware that there is another perspective that is not threatening to you. And so we watched the movie The Other Son, where there's this great fictional drama about, you know, the two families, one Arabic, one Jewish, finding out at the age of military draft that the children had been switched at birth, and what that meant to engage the other family, and sort of all of a sudden say, you're going to be part of my family story now. Right? The important thing isn't to now get it right, right? Get the right baby in the right household. The goal is actually, how do these two families now that are stuck with each other actually find a way to live in peace, even though there's still a lot of healing to be done? Deeper listening. We did the history side by side. We talked about the Palestinian way of viewing things, the Jewish way of viewing things, and we had that great word cloud. Right, where if you just pasted all the words that every Jewish person writes about their history, and you just did a trend analysis only over which words occurred the most frequently, and you had a list of like the top 8 words that always happened, that they always talked about. They always talked about the Holocaust. They always talk about the Promised Land. They always talk about, you know, independence. And you do the same thing. You gather all the texts that have been written from the Palestinian story. You paste them into an algorithm system that kind of churns up and does a word count over what words occur the most frequently. The Palestinians always talk about Britain, not in the Jewish part of the narrative. You know, the Palestinians talk about suffering, but they don't talk about independence. So you get this side of history side by side, the same factual events, all of a sudden becoming almost irreconcilable when placed next to each other, even though they were lived, you know, in real time the same way by everybody else. Risking vulnerability and reclaiming identity, we really did through Promises, which is this documentary that followed these children right through their lives in East Jerusalem. And the sharp contrast of the kids who got together in the Palestinian refugee camp and just played together and wept together, that 3 years later, all of a sudden, how could you have met us and still become a soldier? You know, how could I live in a world knowing that my future is bleak if I let go of hope? No, hope is my resistance, right? All of those really powerful testimonies that have to do with what does it mean to then come back and say, even though I've encountered you, I don't know if I can trust you, but because of your differentness brings into relief some things about who I am that's really important, and some things about who I'm not that's really important. And I think that what we're going to talk a little bit more about today is, What is the place of a Christian identity, right? If the only choices are Arab and versus Jew, you can have a lot of conversations, go home, and not change very much. You just become more tolerant or kinder, right? More aware. But if in Christ we actually have a Christian Palestinian identity, a Messianic Jewish identity, all of a sudden stepping into that Christ identity means that people on your own side may now not like you anymore, because you represent something that's of a different branch of the future. And the people that you are used to be mortal enemies with are now your only allies in this fledgling community where you belong to each other because of something that you shared. And I think that there's something really exciting happening there. We talk about, you know, you have to make a decision at this point whether you want to stay in the process. And we did this very interesting close to home exercise last week. We talked a little bit about, well, we have an issue here in the presbytery around same-sex marriage and their presence and sort of some of the laws and I think it was called an authoritative interpretation that had been voted in by the presbytery. But what does it mean to kind of take all of our own feelings and the personal nature of that particular situation and that particular identity, what would it mean for us to have a family conversation that was not antagonistic, right? Because once again, this is a situation where somebody can be right, somebody can be wrong, but at the end of the day, unless we want the church to split, we're going to have to figure out a way to live together, not necessarily the same as agreeing with each other, but how do we actually still remain in the family of God, even despite these differences, and crafting what that conversation was like. And I really appreciated everybody, you know, being so honest and forthright about putting suggestions on the board. Who was here last week who also went to the town hall meeting that we had afterwards? Now, you guys have a very unique perspective, right? Because we did this exercise right before you went there. Was there anything that kind of like stuck out to you? Were any observations, things that you thought were interesting, things about the Musalaha framework that you observed or thought, you know, brought, came out into relief? Perhaps not.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's very true. Yeah, and I think we actually had talked about that, right? The difficulty of the beginning of the process is showing up in the first place, not being misunderstood as to whether or not you were an ally of one side or the other, but also not wanting to disturb the politesse, right, of coming together and saying, like, well, I like you, I don't want to offend you. Maybe we just talk about everything else instead of the actual issue. Were there any other observations? I thought, so from my perspective, I definitely felt like it was interesting to have gone from this conversation into the town hall, because all of a sudden I'm hyper aware of all of the Musalaha things that were going on, right? So I'm almost like looking for conflict, or I was like looking for somebody to dare to say something or ask a question that felt very, you know, whose side are you on and how are we going to navigate through this? And so I particularly really loved that at the end we were able to at least have the pastoral staff share, you know, sort of where they were coming from, and then also for Ian to say, like, we are actually in Musalaha about this, right? Because we are all pastors, we're on the same team. There's no sides here, but we don't necessarily agree, and we live with each other, and we love each other, and we have an identity in Christ that's our primary identity. And then, like, as pastors of First Press, that are shepherds over the church is our second identity. So I thought that was kind of, like, interesting to get to observe that. And I hope that as we have, you know, I almost hope that any time you leave now and have any kind of conflict situation or debate, that you'll sort of like have that, you know, there's a part of you put the Musalaha hat on and say, oh, I wonder who's being defensive. Oh, I wonder who's withdrawing. That you're asking that other question of whose voice is not heard or who is not staying in the room. So that you sort of have an awareness of how the entire process is going in terms of the conversation. Please. No, I think I've spoken with you a couple times, Lynn, and you are an engineer at heart. So there's a part of you that's very aware of sort of like where the boundaries are, right? Physicist, I'm sorry, where the constraints are, right, in any situation, and that definitely is. What would you say are the non-negotiables that you observe or know about for this situation?
It could indeed end up needing a split as opposed to come to simply agreeing to get along. I'm not sure, in trying to answer your question, from an Israeli or a Palestinian viewpoint, what the non-negotiables are. But personally, I think recognize the right of Israel to exist, and Israel
Yes. Right. And I would say that here is a situation where, we've very intentionally not had a political discussion, right, about what the policy should be that will resolve this issue. It's much more ground floor. And I think so the easy answer that I would want to say is when you love people that are friends, you will make concessions of your non-negotiables out of consideration, right? So I think that there's – I had this great conversation with somebody at lunch who is a Palestinian and activist, and he thinks that settlements are unjust and evil. And I think that there's some merit to his statement, right? There are definitely illegal things that happen and unjust things that happen in the settlements. But then he said, look, the only way that there can be peace is if there's a two-state solution and the settlers wanted to stay and they take a Palestinian ID card and they just want to live as my neighbors, then I must embrace them as my neighbors, right? So here's a situation where something that is feels very, you know, the idea of it, the ideology is extremely non-negotiable and black and white. But when it's like, you know, Joe who lives down the street and he wants to go to school with my kids and he doesn't want to move back to Israel and his kids have been here for the last 5 years, can I look past the ideology of it because the relationship makes it different? And I think that those are kind of like the ground floor examples. I don't know exactly how the policy is going to work, right? And I don't know if I would necessarily claim that any of those people were advocating for a policy where settlers have to take a Palestinian ID card if there was a two-state solution. But they know in their hearts how they would treat their neighbors because of the people who've come into this process. And I think that it would be in the same way that a lot of us, you know, it's like there are things that I dislike doing or like I hate to do or I say I'll never do. Like I don't like to go shopping. But when my sister asks me to take her shopping, like, I always go, and she knows that I'll take her, right? And she knows that I'll sit there for as long as I need to because of my consideration for that relationship. And I think that's sort of the hope that a lot of things that we disagree upon as Christians, right, even within the presbytery, we have so many, there's all these, like, doctrinal things, and there's all these orthodox things, but at the end of the day, there's only one body in Christ. And so there's a part where we have to say, What is the primary thing that we lean in with? And it has to be that relationship. I don't know if that kind of like answers the question. But I think the other thing that Lynn has been speaking with me a couple times about, as well as a number of you here, is when are we going to get past talking, right, and actually start thinking about engaging deeper or solutions? And one, I would say, I don't know if we are ready to come up with solutions when there are no Jews or Palestinians in the room. And two, I want to bring out the fact that we also are not neutral parties with respect to this situation, right? So I want to show this very quick video. Here is a woman, her name is Carol. She is a Palestinian, Israeli, Arab Christian. I think that's correct. So, and she is blonde and blue-eyed, so she found out very early in life that that means that she can look pretty much indigenous with regards to a lot of places where she's a speaker. And she gives this TEDx talk at the end. There's like this plea for something. It's like, look, I've gone through my life story where I did a lot of crossing borders to understand other people's perspectives. But then at one point in my life when I got married and I started having children, it became really important to me that I am not only engaging things that is all about transforming myself inside. There has to be some other kind of impact that will make life better for my kids. And so she kind of like has this great emotional plea, I think, to everybody who's in the room, and it applies to us as well, about some things that she hopes for and also the challenges that she encounters.
Invited here, I was hesitant. I wasn't sure I'm the right person. I know that the people here expect an inspirational message. And I ask myself, what message could I give them? I'm personally facing some doubts about the future of our dialogues. I can't even convince my almost 11-year-old boy that these dialogues are crucial for the survival of both people on this land. He keeps arguing with me. Mom, why should I talk or learn their language if they don't want to learn mine? Mom, why should I be nice to them if they're being rude and forceful with us every time we pass across the airport? Mom, why should I be even talking to them when they are denying the basic right to give my father permanent residency in Israel while he's living with us for more than 14 years in Jerusalem? These are very tough questions that for a mother to answer. But I want to tell you, and I tell him, that I truly and deeply believe in people's power to create change, social, political, or personal. Today, look at the Middle East. We have a new Middle East coming into focus, one that we have never seen before, one we never thought could exist. This is, the world is changing, and approaches to conflict that used to serve us in the past do not address the challenges of today. Activism does. This is a time that calls us all for action. I know for myself that without crossing the borders, I would never be able to see the situation as I see it today. Or I could never be able to see it from so many different angles. This is a time. This is a time that calls us all for action, really. I encourage you to start taking actions by crossing these borders. First, the emotional border, the limitations that fear places on us, and second, the physical border. Go outside of your comfort zone, extend your hand, and be in someone else's story for a while. It could be the smallest steps you can ever think of, but these are the actions that create an influence, the actions that have ripple effects that we might not even know about. When we go outside of what we know, then we have the opportunity to move from a place of us, opposite the other, to a more generous space, one that contains us both. Thank you.
So, I want to point out a couple of things about that sharing that's different. First of all, that is the first woman that we've heard in all of our movies and conversations. I think that is also the first Christian that we've heard. And she's speaking so very powerfully about what it means to move away from a place where your future and your decisions are dictated only by fear, into a place where there is generosity, hope, and a combined sense of belonging. And the other thing that is so palpable is that she is not doing it hoping that she will see it in her generation. But she's doing it because if she does not, then her son will embrace all of the fearfulness and hatred and resentfulness that comes from living in that kind of environment. And I think that if there's anything that we talk about later today in our interactive, more post-its exercise, I do want us to think a little bit about that. Everybody that we've spoken to, everybody that Debbie has told me about, they're saying is, look, there's a wall here. There's a physical wall, and there are emotional walls. And yes, those walls are protection for many, many people. And they are a symbol of resentment and oppression for many, many people. But at the end of the day, if our children are ever to be able to have peace, there cannot be any walls. And it may be removing the walls will mean danger for the next 20 years or 40 years. But if you never remove the wall, then our children will never be able to be friends. And there's something so interesting about that eternal perspective, right? That it's not for me, and I know that it may even be more dangerous, maybe in the same way that it was dangerous for the father to release the prodigal son, right, to let him go in the mob. But there's something about that longer-term view that I think is so worthwhile and so different from what we see today in our society. So let's keep on talking. So now this is a part for, like, one, we need to start with our own confession, right? We are not able to be neutral parties in this. I personally was so convicted when I went to the Middle East, how little I know and how little I still know about the history of that place. How little I even realized that there were Palestinian Arab Christians. How I do not know even this day where the Arab Christian churches, if they exist, are in this county. I do not know these things. I've been to Shabbat service at the temple on Bancroft like once or twice, but I've not engaged, and yet our country sends so much money to the Middle East every year. Our presbytery is voting on issues related to the Middle East as we speak. The Christians who are in Palestine who have invited us to come to Christ to the checkpoint, oftentimes they'll ask the question, do people even know or care that we're here? Do people care if we die out? If in 10 years there is no living church in the city of Bethlehem, the city of Christ's birth, and it's only churches where tourists go on pilgrimage, will that be a loss for you in America? And I think you wanted to share something, but the fact that they even had to ask the question means that we have not properly communicated our care, and I know that my ignorance was part of that. So the whole idea of coming to this class is, in a way, sort of having a musalaha conversation where we ourselves are culpable in many ways as part of the story, and we have a role in this history as Christians and as Americans, and then as a world body, I think a powerful voice with which to encourage reconciliation in this future, especially because we are Christians. I think that you wanted to share something. I think that's a really good point. And once again, the goal is not to take sides, right? I think, you know, Europeans going in there to be the heroes is how we got into this trouble in the first place. So definitely not wanting to do that, particularly not wanting to put some sort of Christendom kind of label on that either. I feel like those things always do more damage than good when Christians try to instigate policy for somebody else's country. But I do think that there are things that, and I think this is right, we need to be very aware of the kind of language that's being used, you know, both in our own conversations as well as what we hear on the news. It's pretty obvious more and more that I listen, I can tell from the headline of an article what side they represent, right? And I think the goal is to sort of navigate it in a way where when I'm having my own conversations, I don't represent a side, I represent reconciliation, right? And there's something so nuanced and layered about that, it's actually quite complex. But I know that if I'm not careful with my words, that I can make enemies of friends. And so being aware of that and sort of being able to detect, right, be as wise as serpents, but also as gentle as doves in the way that we approach this kind of a conflict situation or any conflict situation. Right? I think that's really important. I want to talk a little bit about the most recent vote that was taken for the PCUSA, but maybe I'll let Debbie do that. I'll kind of share with you a little bit about what Palestinian Christians that I've spoken to actually think about this kind of a sanction.
So how many of you are aware that at the General Assembly last week there was another vote besides the same-sex marriage vote? It's on the divestment from limited divestment in three companies that the PCUSA does business with, Motorola, HP, and Caterpillar are the three companies. So it wasn't a complete call for complete divestment from Israel. It's not part, it's an aspect of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that has been gaining ground in Europe in particular against Israel. And this is modeled after what happened in South Africa, is the idea of trying to put pressure on Israel to engage in more just practices towards the Palestinians. And this, when you're in the BDS movement, the language that they use is that Israel is actually an apartheid state and all this kind of stuff, which, as you can imagine, evokes a tremendous amount of emotion on both sides and a tremendous amount of defensiveness and resistance on Israel's side. So anything affiliated with anything that's related to boycott, divestment, or sanctions is often from what would you imagine the Israelis would probably accuse someone who's advocating for that, just what you know from this. What are they going to say? If you're for anything related to divestment, what would that make you towards the Israelis? Anti-Semitic. Okay, and if you say, forget BDS and everything is fine, status quo, what would the Palestinians accuse the world or people who would resist that movement? They would say they're for the oppressor, right? It's unjust. So these two things get very, this is what you're going to hear in the news. So anyway, the decision was made by the Presbyterians to divest from these three companies because they have, they do a tremendous amount of work that is involved in the security and in the destruction of Palestinian livelihood. Caterpillar for their earth-moving equipment that has leveled villages and many of the trees, for Motorola, and for HP for their technology that is used in security issues and screenings and things like that. What they did not do is call for all of the Presbyterians to boycott these companies. They just said, according to the just practices that the Presbyterian Church already has in their bylaws, these companies were not meeting that standard and therefore have voted to divest themselves from these three companies. So if you look at the rhetoric going around on both sides, and I would encourage you to actually read the actual statement by the General Assembly, you can see the heightenedness of these two narratives that are now being at play and at conflict with one another. So anybody have any questions about that? Yeah, Charlotte.
So how do they specifically divest?
These are
directly investing in those companies.
No, the national churches, through its pension fund, through its own investment. Yes, they asked the pension funds to not invest in anything related to that. And the Presbyterians, their justice whole arm, had actually gone to each one of these companies trying to have a conversation with them before they made this vote. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that I don't think is important here, just to say that it's actually a live issue, though. And this issue comes down to where are the Presbyterians going to stand in this narrative, right? That's why it's very troubling for many people. Many people say, okay, you've now just ruined, listen to the rhetoric, Presbyterians have broken all relationships with Jewish organizations, with their Jewish brothers and sisters, and this is horrible for interfaith dialogue that we've had. Okay? It's a little extreme to say that because they say you no longer support the right of Israel to exist is the most extreme accusation that's made against the church. From what I just told you, is that quite right? No, again, it's a narrative in service to, it's shaping the facts in service to a particular narrative, right? That's trying to convince people of that one side is right. Okay. The other side is that, I mean, even to many of the Palestinians, some of them are thrilled about this, but they don't think it went far enough. You know, they say, so what? Three little companies? Israel's the problem. Not their three little companies. These are American companies that are doing this. Why not? You know, nobody is boycotting SodaStream, which builds their little soda machine in the settlements in Mu'alli Adumim, right outside of Jerusalem. They didn't go far enough, right? If you really want to stand for justice, then do something significant. So again, the Presbyterians didn't go far enough. So yeah, Lynn.
Doesn't exactly tell
So it would be, it's an interesting thing. It's a, for many people, they would see, the interpretation would be that the political is around justice. And so having policy or supporting policies that feel like they're in the place of justice is why this decision was made. But regardless of all that, I just want to tell you about two different things that happened last week, or one thing that happened last week. Netanyahu, anyway, Bibi, issued a statement to the Presbyterians last week. If you didn't hear it, you have a personal invitation now to come to Israel. And he said, come and see. We want you to come and see that this is the only functioning democracy in the Middle East. So come and see what Israel does before you make this decision. And he has an idea of what you would come and see and therefore what you would value and think. Well, what is the one word that we hear from our Palestinian brothers and sisters all the time, every time you're there? They don't ask us to come and do. They don't ask us to come and fix. They say, come and see. They say the same thing. Come and see for yourself. So it's an interesting thing that as we're talking about all this, and Max noted, we have no Jews in the room, we have no Palestinians in the room, that this is actually an invitation, I think, that's one that's worthwhile for us to come and see for ourselves. And when you go with me on a trip, you might understand that I have an affinity towards the Palestinian Christians because they're my brothers and sisters in Christ. I have met some Messianic Jews, but I haven't spent as much time. They're a much smaller group. But in many ways, when you come with me, I'm not going to tell you one way or the other how to vote or what to think. And we've been really particular. We haven't talked to you guys about a one-state solution, a two-state solution, a 30-state solution. All we've done is tried to give you the narratives as we understand them. And if you go for yourself, it's worthwhile to go and see, to go to see and listen, and to see for yourself what is going on. And Netanyahu has given you the invitation to come. The Palestinian Christians, who don't have quite that much power, have also invited you to come. So the question is, will we? And if not, how can we come and see when we can't physically go there? And part of that's been what we've tried to do in this class.
Thanks, Debbie. So I think the question, right, that does come up a lot of times is, why should the church have an official stance? Why is it worthwhile for us as Christians to have some sort of opinion? And I'm going to do what I consider to be my most ambitious dramatic exercise to date, which is that I have actually gone through and pieced together a lot of the feedback and the conversations that I've had with Palestinians as well as with Israelis, with Jews. And I'm going to share with you a little bit about how they construct the narrative of the United States Christians, or maybe of European Christians, right? The Palestinians would say, one, when we were sleeping and we had no idea that there was even plans for people to take our land away from us, Christians supported a movement that said that the land of Christ belongs to the people of the Old Testament and forgot that we also were people of the Old Testament. In fact, they forgot that the church was birthed in Palestine, and there were Christians who were the original Christians from the Pentecost days that had been there. And instead, they came back and missionized to us as if this faith did not belong to our land, and we were only Muslims here. And then they have continued to make us invisible and not done anything to stand up for our voice or even to share our perspective because we were hidden away by the wall. And they accuse us of being terrorists and are afraid to come. They allow Israel to do a lot of things because of Europe's guilt in the Holocaust, and we were never even involved in World War II. It is our hope today to call the Western Christian people to action because we do not feel that it is just that we should be invisible to our brothers and sisters as if we were outsiders, and that they who are our brothers and sisters would allow other people to malign us and call us terrorists when we are dying out. All right? This is what the Palestinian Christians have often said to me. They would say also that U.S. Protestant churches have had a history of preaching Zionism in schools and in their Sunday schools, which is a belief theologically that hurts us as people. When you say that God tells me that I have to evict my home and be a refugee, and then you teach your children that God commands this to be true and right, It hurts me. And no one has ever come here to talk to us about it. They just come here and avoid us. You parachute into our holy sites, and you never meet us, the living stones. This is the narrative that they would tell. On the Jewish side, what they would say is, the Catholics have had a long history of calling us Christ killers, even though Jesus was himself a Jew, and never denied his Jewishness. Because of the Catholics and some other people who supported this flame of demonizing us, there have been political cartoons that make fun of us. There have been pogroms that have persecuted us. And we have suffered for many, many years just trying to be good citizens and not being allowed to be even given a chance. We were very hopeful when we heard that some people came and recognized that God had made us a promise that cannot be taken away from us, which is that we will one day return to the land of our forefathers because of the covenant of Abraham. It was our rejoicing that finally God was moving in this way despite so many people who had opposed his will. It was God who also supported us when we had to rally against the threat of six nations against us. And even though we were very small, we were victorious. This was God at work. And we believe that when the Christians who were outside saw God at work, they began also to understand that God was working in a way that was for Israel. And so many churches gave us money to be able to send more and more people to immigrate back here. But we are not stupid people, we Jews. We understand that the Christians have their own agenda when they give us money to immigrate people here. We know that in their Bible, in Revelation, when the Jews return, many of them will die in the end times. And you are hastening the return of Christ by giving us this money, but it is not necessarily for our good. That being said, we will still take your money. Because we are not stupid people, we Jews. We will demonstrate to you that our God is just as faithful as the God you claim to have power in. And even though we have often enjoyed the fact that the Protestants, unlike the Catholics, have been very friendly to Jews, and the fact that some Protestants and Christians were actually involved with helping Jews escape during the Holocaust, our relationship with you is tentative at best. You have not shown yourselves to be true friends. You have only shown yourself sometimes to be less enemies and always stood out for your own good more than you have cared to come and listen to us. In the villages when we were being persecuted, you did not stand up for us, although maybe you did not participate in some of the tortures that happened. And so, when the presbytery starts to vote on BDS, right? As Jews, we become a little bit apprehensive that they will stop giving us the money that we have enjoyed for so long, and we are afraid that this is actually the first step towards greater enmity. When you have never really shown yourself to be a true friend, and you have preached things that were sort of for us, but ultimately with your own gain in mind, any withdrawal of support feels very dangerous. Not entirely sure what to think. But sometimes I think that maybe if the U.S. just stopped meddling altogether and left us alone, in 50 years we will get along, and that you actually, any forces who insist upon meddling, actually make things a lot worse. So, two very different perspectives, all of which we are not innocent bystanders. And when I go to Israel, one, they're all, everybody there is very, very eager to engage. Two, I work for Google, so they're like additionally eager to engage. And so Sergey Brin is Jewish, so he actually has a lot of investments in Israel. But three, he kind of like says, what kind of friend are you? Are you the I just do no evil type? Or are you actually going to like pitch in and help us? And then this is like, well, actually, no, maybe I don't want you to help us at all. Maybe I just want you to leave us alone. And there's just like this very... I think for the Israelis, especially some of the more secular Jews, there's this very interesting kind of love-hate relationship with the United States. And when they find out that I'm Christian, actually a lot of times what they'll ask me is, like, what type of Christian are you? And I was like, oh, I'm the non-Catholic type. And yeah, I can't really say, like, evangelical, right, because they don't know what that means. And one, they'll say, oh, I like being Jewish because I only have to repent for sins that I do, not sins that are in my heart. So it's the more honest kind of confession. They say that. And then two, they'll say, do you have any Jewish friends? And they ask that very, very early in the conversation. They'll ask me that. And in the same way that it's so funny, Palestinians will ask me, oh, you're American? What airport did you fly in from? Ben-Gurion? I can never fly out of that airport. It's interesting, right? But we are not, we go in as known entities. And I think they're like kind of like looking to see if we fulfill their expectations or if we do something that surprises them. And in so doing, we cannot be neutral. We cannot be outsiders. Please. Yeah, so one of the really interesting things that happened very recently actually at work was Sergey Brin, who is one of the co-founders of Google, he had created a set of entrepreneurship programs for moms. So there's like these study centers where moms, especially Israelis, can go and learn programming or learn how to start their own business. A year and a half ago, we acquired an Israeli company called Waze, which is this traffic app. But 3 months ago, Google Ventures, which is the part of Google that I worked with, actually brought in as an entrepreneur in residence, Wild Gronem, who was one of the people that started the revolution in Egypt, and he is Arab. So it's this very interesting conversation we're having about, like, well, what does it mean to imagine a better future in the Middle East? And Wael would say, be careful, I'm Arab. like literally, he's like, how did you feel about that? And he's like, be careful, I'm Arab. And that's the first thing that he'll say. And then the second thing that he will say is, I don't understand why we are not doing more things. With technology as advanced as it is today, we are not doing more things to enable people to talk across borders in an easy way. Right? So he's actually being able to have both of those voices in one room when we have board meetings has been really, really interesting from that perspective. And I think it allows me the ability to trust, right, some of my leaders, even though Sergey has his own personal history involved with it, that, like, when Wael was imprisoned, actually, for being part of the revolution, but he worked for Google, and we spent 3 to 4 months actually getting him out of prison, and now he can never go back to his home country. So he is immigrating here, and we're being part of the visa process. So it does feel like, oh, you know, there are these circumstances which will allow us to have both voices. It's not a Palestinian voice, but an Arab voice in the room. Yep. Oh, absolutely.
People are making money and companies are making money. How do we try to overcome that?
Yeah. I mean, on a very basic level, if everybody in Palestine was able to get on the internet, then they would search for things in Google and we would make more money. And that's like on a very simple level, that is always in our favor, right? But two, it Google is also very aware that when you give people who have no internet access to information in real time, they start to write blogs, they start to make movies, they start to share things with the external world, and like sometimes governments are toppled, right? This is some of the things that we saw with Myanmar, actually, which is a deep engagement. Just the things that allow them to bypass censorship because of technology. And if there is no security, if you have to fear for your lives, then one, we will not make money off of ads, and two, you don't have the luxury to actually embrace technology, right? And that also means that there's thousands of talented people who don't get educated, who don't contribute, and are lost. And that's not something that I'm willing to accept, and that's not something that I think I'm able to go to my company or people are able to go to my company and say, like, we don't accept this, right? So what are we going to do about it? And for them to say, like, I have no solutions. Want to talk to your church.
Because it's
if their government also is going to stifle anything in China, that cuts off
the right. And well, and the other thing is that you can start to teach yourself, right? If you're illiterate and you have access to the internet, you can actually cobble together your own curriculum for learning. In a way that, like, if there are schools that get blown up or schools that get bulldozed and there's no other way to get information, it's harder to educate yourself. And I do feel like education is one of those keys to having something better. All right, so we are actually going to do, we're going to ask this question, and we're going to do a D-School exercise, Stanford D-School exercise called How Might We?, which is a brainstorming exercise, and we're going to use Post-its once again. The question is, how might we engage? And I think that the goal is actually not necessarily to come up with solutions, but the goal is to come up with clarifying questions, right? We've heard a number of different things in this class, and today's class was even a little bit muddy because we had to grasp together so many threads and put them together. But what are some questions that we would want to ask to deepen our understanding and to work towards engagement for this particular land? A question might be, you know, how might we better learn about moms working across both sides of the wall? Right. Another question might be, how might Max be able to put up the screen because he is incompetent? You know, the goal might be, you know, how might we steer conversations away from politics into more about relationships and communities? A conversation, you know, maybe a question that, thank you so much. A question might be, how might we identify the most vulnerable people who still don't have a voice, even in Palestine or in Israel? Right. So to start asking some of these questions, and then we can frame what you know, learning we want to do for the next class, what potential engagements. If we were to ask the question, how might we identify the top 10 injustices, right, that are often perpetrated when Israelis arrest Palestinian children for throwing rocks? Then that might mean that our next step has to be, well, we got to learn about the judicial system, and maybe we need to go do a tour of the prisons, because children do throw rocks, and they do get arrested for throwing rocks. if the question is, how might we better protect women and girls who are vulnerable culturally in this time when there is no peace? Then, you know, the next step might be to actually think about what it would mean to do a learning center or to invest in a learning center where women are able to get together and read the Lean In book or understand how to navigate work-life balance. And one thing that's been interesting is, I think Debbie was sharing with me, right now the Palestinian children who throw rocks are all boys. And sometimes the girls think to themselves, like, what if I also throw rocks? But it is so much more dangerous, right, for girls to go to jail because they can get raped and they can be abused. But they want to have a voice in their country's resistance, and there's no other way that they can see where anybody is doing anything except to burn tires and to throw rocks, right? So if the question is, how might we give girls in Palestine something real that they can do to contribute to their own future so that they do not end up like that girl in Promises who says, my future is just always uncertain. The only thing that I can do is just hold on to hope, but I have no power externally and I have no engagement potential. Then, you know, our next step for what that would mean to learn how we even begin to answer that question would look like something very different, right? It might be building schools or it might be, you know, going into the communities and doing more mentoring. So I want to give us a couple of minutes just to put up questions that are feel like, oh, questions that are unsolved for you through this learning, either about one, the United States Christians and their engagement, or two, about the situation and the stories that we've heard from both sides of the wall.
Thank you. I have to run.
Debbie has to preach, so she's going to leave, and I'm going to go ahead and close out the class. Please do feel free to keep putting the questions on. There will actually be data points for us to figure out where next to go with regards to this particular adventure. And I do sincerely appreciate everybody for having come. There are readers that are downstairs in the reception area that is part of the J-PAL group, of which Palestine is part of a study and investigation that we're doing around displaced and refugees and particularly how are women and girls vulnerable in places of injustice, poverty, and oppression with regards to Palestinian refugees and displaced people groups. The reader itself focuses on a very specific issue that I've been researching. So because I'm researching and I put together the reader, you get to do what I do, which is that the home demolitions that are happening illegally, where there are bulldozers like Caterpillar bulldozers that go, and even though the families have land deeds to the houses that they're in, because they have no military, the houses get torn down. And culturally, that means that the women have no place to socialize, and oftentimes the girls have to walk further to school, and that becomes a point of vulnerability where they can be harassed. So in the Middle East, because most of it is Muslim, it's very important for women to always be within containers, right? They have to be protected, they have to be covered. And if a house is bulldozed, and the men can like grab lawn chairs, sit in front of a shop with their hookahs and their, you know, coffee, and socialize and learn and have class. They can do it in broad daylight under, you know, the sky. There's no issues. But the girls cannot. So now they have no place to play. The women do not have a place to cook. And so it becomes a great shame for them to not have their own kitchen or refrigerator to prepare foods in. Because their houses were bulldozed down, they have no property, right? They have no money with which to go buy new homes. And so home demolitions become a particularly vulnerable place for women and girls. And so I kind of share a little bit about that research in the reader that I put together. I also included some background on when women have tried to engage in political activism in the history of Palestine, right, all the way from 48, pre-48, the things that have happened to them, and places where they've been very powerful, but also places where they have been shockingly abused. During the first intifada, before the second intifada, there were women activists who would go to meetings where they would try to fight for policy rights, you know, or they would try to fight for more water for their villages. And because they were, you know, modern women, strong women, independent women, they would not wear their veils, even if they were Muslim. And there were numerous cases where they were date raped. Basically, the drinks would be drugged and they would be raped. And there would be a shame, right? It'd be like, you sent your representatives and we raped them. No water for you, right? It was such a powerful political statement in these kinds of power struggles at a very, very tense time that women leaders, advocates, would encourage one another to, A, take back the veil, and two, lie and say that they were fasting. And it was actually, there was this policy, that, like a letter that that a woman wrote to other fellow leaders that said, we discourage social drinking. By that, I do not mean alcohol. I mean no Coca-Cola, no iced tea, nothing that does not come in a sealed can should be consumed in a social setting because of this kind of vulnerability. So it's, I mean, both really, really brave and also very interesting kind of to look at the time frame of how in this honor shame society, as Debbie mentioned in her sermon, a lot of times if you shame the women of a society, you shame their entire national identity, right? Because if you cannot even protect your wives and your children, what right do you have to come here and fight with me about your entitlements? And so there's been this like interesting history of how women have often become both vulnerable, but also then the key, right, to the honor of that society. And so it's definitely a place where I think there's such an important role that women can play as mothers who are doing things for their children, but also in this society where if the women are lifted up, in a way, the national pride also gets lifted up as well. Okay. You all have evaluation forms. I will let you guys do that. But thank you so much for taking time to come and be part of this. And I'm looking forward to whatever God is doing with us next.